Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hello and welcome to Connecting Faith. I always appreciate the opportunity to get together with you and have interesting conversations. Today will be one of those days. Glad to have you tuned in. I'm Neil Stavem, and today we're going to learn about helping your child succeed in school. You know, for more than 40 years and counting, family psychologist and best-selling author John Roseman has been counseling parents about how to help children do their best in school. And we want to focus on that today and probably get into a little bit more of his many books. He's written some 15-plus best-selling books on parenting and the family. He's a family psychologist who's directed mental health programs and been in full-time private practice working with families, children, and parents for more than 40 years, and spends much of his time speaking and writing. His parenting column syndicated in some 250 newspapers. And one of the books that we talked with him not too long ago was his latest, called Grandma Was Right After All. It was practical parenting wisdom from the good old days, but we want to go back a year or so because he updated one of his helpful books called John Roseman's Fail-Safe Formula for Helping Your Child Succeed in School. And so we're going to focus at least to start on homework and some of those issues and school challenges. John, welcome back to Connecting Faith, first of all.
Oh, well, thank you, Neil. Thanks for inviting me back on the show.
You know, your approach to, and I'll let you kind of define your approach to kind of getting kids to do homework, it seems pretty straightforward. I'm wondering, do parents push back and say that won't work, or where do you get the biggest reaction?
Well, I think that is the biggest reaction. When I tell parents that all of the research, and in addition to that, my extensive experience confirms that the more independent children are where homework is concerned, the higher their achievement levels in school. The pushback is, well, John, that may work for most kids, but my kid won't do his homework. My kid won't do his best unless I'm sitting there and making sure he does it and helping him and so on. And my rejoinder to that is, well, what you don't realize is that as long as you sit there helping him and making sure he's going to do it, the longer you're going to have to sit there helping him and making sure he's going to do it. You're caught up into a vicious circle, and the only way you're going to break out of this is to step back and let him figure this out on his own. And indeed, when you do that, when a parent does that, Neil, what happens is the child's performance level does slip. It goes down because what you're doing is removing all of the enabling. And when you remove the enabling, the child has to go through a period of adjustment. But almost invariably, within 4 to 6 weeks, the child's performance level comes back up again and in very short order begins to exceed the level at which he was performing before.
You use the word helping, but I'm thinking we probably put that in quotes, right? It's not we're not really helping, even though we think we are.
Well, according to the research, and people think, you know, that people like me who are called parenting experts, that we have opinions. And some people in my field do only have opinions. But the fact of the matter is that all of the recommendations that I make are based on solid research. And the research is that the longest, most extensive, broadest study on parent participation in homework that has ever been done confirms what is counterintuitive, and that is that the less help parents give, the higher a child's achievement level will ultimately be.
We're going to unpack that a little bit more, but I thought maybe just in the beginning, you talk about maybe we need to relearn our ABCs. And since we're talking about, you know, helping kids succeed in school, just summarize what you mean by that.
Well, the homework ABCs are A is all by myself. And what that means is that the child is in a room or a place that is designated as his homework area. And then by myself means the parent is not there with the child, and C is call it quits. Set an upper limit on the amount of time that a child can spend doing homework. So you say to the child, and this is what we did with our kids. They had to do homework in their room. They could not do homework in a family area, because what I found, my wife found, was that if the kids were doing homework in a family area, A, they asked for help. They were more likely to ask for help. If they were doing the homework in their own rooms, they were less likely to do so. They had to get help, come out of their rooms, come downstairs, find us. And quite frankly, they didn't want to go through the effort. And so they would set up in their rooms and they would figure problems out that they wouldn't have figured out on their own otherwise. And then we told them, you can't work on homework past, you know, my kids are in their 40s now, Neil, so I'm pulling this out of my hat, but it was, you can't work on homework past 7:30, I believe, something like that. At 7:30, you have to put your homework away, and we have family time, and whether it's done or not. And the children very quickly learned to adjust their own schedules to meet that deadline. And it worked out very, very well. And interestingly enough, our son, when we started doing this, he was in the third grade, and his teacher in the middle of the year informed us that she was going to hold him back. She wasn't going to promote him because he was achieving a year and a half below grade level and would have qualified, by the way, as learning disabled. And we took the very, very radical step of stopping the adult homework help, and which again is counterintuitive. Here's a kid who's in danger of failing, and the parents are saying to the child, well, you're going to have to do your homework on your own from now on. We had been sitting with him at the kitchen table every single evening from the time dinner was over until who knows when, trying to get the homework done. And within 3 months of this, he was achieving at grade level, and his teacher met with us. And she actually used the term miracle. She said, I feel like I've witnessed a miracle of the last 3 months. Eric is achieving at grade level, and if he continues this way, I will have no choice but to move him to the fourth grade. And he did go to the fourth grade. And from that point on, he didn't sail through school. I'm one of the only parents in the world, apparently, who doesn't have gifted children. But, he did reasonably well, got into a good college, and is now an international corporate pilot. And this is a kid who is an academic wreck halfway through the third grade.
Talking to John Roseman today, who does not have a bumper sticker on his car about his exceptional child. John, is this something that, if you don't start it early on, like when your children are in grade school, that is this something you kind of have to work up to, this approach?
No, it really isn't. When I'm asked the question, well, John, how do we phase this in, this change in our parenting style, my answer to that is you don't phase it in. If you try to phase it in, you'll never get there. You'll hit so many bumps in the road in the course of phasing it in that you'll give up. You just have to do this pretty much cold turkey. You have to get your heads together as husband and wife. You have to get your plan together and be very, very clear on what your plan is going to be. You have to be extremely well organized in your approach and your explanation to the child. It needs to be, as Grandma used to put it, short and sweet, and just simply, this is the way it is. You don't ask the child permission to do this. and then you just do it. And there will be, you know, as I said earlier, some period of transition and even some emotional turmoil on the part of the child. But if you stay the course, it'll all, as they say, come out in the wash, and everybody will be the better for it.
You know, we're, as parents, we're not really so good at handling emotional turmoil for whatever the cause. But this is probably one of those where we really we begin to question our judgment, perhaps, because, as you say, it is so counterintuitive.
Well, you know, there were a set of parenting aphorisms that people in my generation were very, very familiar with as we grew up. And one of those was, I'm just going to let you stew in your own juices about this, which indicated that there was 60 years ago in American parenting a clear emotional boundary between parent and child. And so the child could react emotionally to a parent decision, and the parent was unmoved by the child's emotional reaction and said to the child, I'm just going to let you stew in your own juices about this. Today's parents, unfortunately, because the mental health professional community, which largely doesn't know what it's talking about, and I am a psychologist, and I'm saying that, the mental health professional community in the 1960s began to emphasize the need for parents to understand and properly respond to children's feelings. And so parents today feel their children's pain, is the way I put it. The parent feels the child's pain. And because of that, the parent gets drawn into the child's emotional reaction to the parent decision and begins to question, therefore, whether the decision was the proper decision or not. And this is, you know, the parent begins waffling back and forth. Oh, my gosh, you know, maybe I made the wrong decision because my child is weeping, you know, this kind of thing. And the thing I point out to parents is, look, Proverbs 22:15 tells you foolishness is bound in the heart of the child. This is your child's emotional reaction to a decision that you have made is 99.9% of the time simply an outburst of the foolishness that is, and the word is bound, almost imprisoned in the child's heart. You mustn't let the child's emotional reaction sway a decision that you have made or are about to make.
Getting wise parenting advice today, maybe some counterintuitive parenting advice today from John Rosemond, who has worked with families, children, and parents for more than 40 years in the field of family psychology and has written some 15 best-selling books. The one we're referencing today is John Rosemond's Fail-Safe Formula for Helping Your Child Succeed in School. And we're going to continue in just a moment with more on Connecting Faith. John Rosemond is my guest today. We're talking about his book, Helping Your Child. It's John Rosemond's Fail-Safe Formula for Helping Your Child Succeed in School. It's a revised and updated edition of one of his classic parenting guides. He's a nationally recognized expert offering practical advice and methods for setting your kids on the path to success in school as early as age 3. And John, I guess, you know, one of the questions that you want to know is, I mean, is there ever a time when a parent should help their child with their homework?
Well, there is a time when it is appropriate for a supervisor in the workplace to provide some assistance to an employee who is struggling with a task. And so, yeah, there is a time for that. You have to be very prudent about that sort of thing. And when I use that analogy, Neil, I point out that, well, the help from the workplace manager is usually needed as the employee is first learning the task. Once the employee has learned the task or has gotten off to a fairly good start, you need to pull back and let the employee go through the trial and error of perfecting his learning of the task. And the same is true of children. The child may need some homework help initially concerning an academic challenge that is brand new, unrelated to anything the child has ever tackled before. But at some point, you need to have the judgment to pull back and let the child work this out on their own. My daughter Amy, when she entered her sophomore year of high school, had to take geometry. And as is the case with girls in general, and it's not, you know, a hard and fast rule. I want to make clear on that so that people don't start throwing things at the radio. But as is general, girls have some difficulty in math. Boys have difficulty in language arts. She came to me and told me that she was just completely baffled by the geometry that she was learning. So for about 2 weeks, I gave her about 15 minutes of help a night, just kind of starting her off on her assignments, because I had been a fairly good math student in high school. So at the end of 2 weeks, I realized she was becoming extremely dependent upon my help. And so on the next day, she came to me and said, "Daddy, I really need some help with this." And I said, "Honey, I've gotten you off to a good start here in geometry, and I've made a decision, and the decision is that I'm not going to give you any more help. You're on your own from this point. And I really do think I've given you enough help that you can build on what we've done together and figure this out from this point on your own." And, you know, the emotional, it was a longer encounter than this. First, she tried to persuade me that she really needed the help. Then she started crying. And then she started, you know, getting very angry at me because I wouldn't move. And finally, she stormed up the stairs saying, "Fine, then I'll just fail geometry," you know, very dramatically, you know, young teenage girl. And she made an A in geometry. In fact, she made straight A's through the year. I'm convinced, by the way, that if I had continued to give her help, she would have continued to believe she couldn't do geometry. And at the end of the year, she believed that she was capable of tackling geometry. And that, by the way, increased her confidence that she was capable of dealing with other academic things without daddy, other academic challenges without daddy's help.
Which I guess kind of comes up against the emphasis, it seems, today, where there's a focus on self-esteem, where everybody gets a participation trophy. Maybe you want to just react to that a bit.
Well, again, the research. Here's the research. The research all indicates. See, what the American parent doesn't know is that the idea that high self-esteem, esteem or the self, that's exactly what it means, was a good thing, was snatched out of thin air by the secular humanist psychology movement in the 1960s. And no psychological theory has ever been proven correct, none. And indeed, the research now clearly states that high self-esteem actually depresses performance, because the person with high self-esteem believes that anything he does is worthy of merit. And when you believe that any old thing you do is worthy of merit, you don't do your best. And so America's public schools are way behind the curve on this, because they really wrapped themselves around this whole high self-esteem concept. And this is one reason why, despite the fact that we have been lowering the teacher-pupil ratio in the American classroom, the achievement level continues to go down. And I keep telling people, look, America's student achievement was never as high as it was in the 1950s when classrooms were overcrowded. We need to understand that it is not small classrooms that produce optimal learning. It is children who come to school prepared to pay attention and prepared to do what they are told. It's not a high IQ that predicts success. It's perseverance and it's courage and it's biblical values like that that Paul speaks about it, as a matter of fact.
We'll come back and talk more about that in the next segment of our program. I want to maybe just before we take our next break, talk a little bit about the kind of homework that kids are getting today. I mean, children are adults now, but are they getting assignments that sort of make sense and that they can actually figure out, or is it just sort of you have to do some work outside of class, and so here's a project of one sort or another? Do you have any perspective on that?
Well, they're getting homework that prepares them for the national achievement test they have to take. Everything in America's public schools is geared around the achievement test that the kids have to take sometime during the year. And, funding depends on this. The number of teachers you can hire depends on this. The rating that your school gets depends on this. Whether kids in your school can leave and go to other schools depend on this. And so America's public educational system has devolved into simply a place where kids learn facts that are completely unconnected to context and completely unconnected to principle. So these kids are not learning, they're just memorizing. That's all they're doing. There's a complete difference, which is why, by the way, Neil, since we're on the topic, and what I'm about to say doesn't reflect on the people involved or the people in the system, it reflects on the system. And that is that I would not send my children to a public school today if somebody paid me to do so. It wouldn't happen.
Did you consider homeschooling your children?
I didn't have to because The public school that we sent our kids to was right around the corner. It was integrated without any government intervention, and it was a neighborhood school, and it was responsive to the community. And what was taught in the school reflected the values of the community, and that's the way public schools were up until the mid-1970s, when they just began to become laboratories for left-wing socialist ideological experiments.
Coming up in a moment, we're going to talk a little bit about schools today that aren't really able to discipline students any longer. What do we do when your child misbehaves at school? We'll get to that and more. We're referencing John Roseman's fail-safe formula for helping your child succeed in school. It was revised out last year, and John's also written a new book called Grandma Was Right After All, Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days. We'll touch on that as we go along as well. John's family psychologist, and he's a best-selling author and syndicated columnist, and speaks around the country. And he's joining us today on Connecting Faith, and there's more coming up in just a moment. Listening to Connecting Faith, and we've connected again with John Roseman. We had a chance to talk with him a few months back about his new book, Grandma Was Right After All, Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days. And we wanted to revisit one of the topics that he has talked about over the years in his 40 years of practice helping families, children, and parents in directing mental health programs and a family psychologist. He also writes a parenting column and has written some 15 best-selling books. What we want to talk about is his fail-safe formula for helping your child succeed in school. And as we've heard, and maybe in case you missed it, John's basically say kids do it by themselves. They do their homework by themselves, and we're going to kind of review that again as we go along. By the way, I guess maybe just to review the ABCs again, just because you talked about setting limits on there, and I want to just have you expand on that a little bit.
Well, in the book, the fail-safe formula, a long title. When I saw that, I was kind of shocked, actually. My publishers put it out there. John Roseman's fail-safe approach to helping your child succeed in school. I talk about the homework ABCs. The first part of the book is homework management. And the A stands for all by myself. In other words, the child does his homework in his room. B stands for by myself, which means that parents aren't involved sitting there helping the child do his homework. And C stands for call it quits, that parents need to set an upper limit, a deadline per evening as that defines when homework has to be done and put away. And what I have found is that when parents observe those three simple rules in setting up a homework management program, that things go extremely well and homework doesn't become a family drama.
Why call it quits? Because, I mean, I'm sure many parents are saying, you know, my child is underperforming. They're not up to their abilities. So wouldn't having them do more homework encourage higher achievement?
Well, no. The studies have found, in fact, Neil, that you reach a point of diminishing returns with homework. And the point is reached at different places with different children. But at a certain point, the doing of homework becomes counter-motivational. In other words, the child begins to view academics as not a challenge, but a burden, and begins to dislike school because that's where the burden is assigned. And by the way, this is what's going on in America's, again, public schools and all too many private schools, and in fact, all too many Christian schools, is the powers that be believe that the more homework they give, the more learning will take place. And the research just simply doesn't confirm that at all. It disconfirms it. I keep telling people, you know, that the schools are not paying attention to the research. If they did, they would operate in a completely different fashion than the way they are operating today.
Does the child's learning style influence maybe how a parent provides the kind of right framework for that that homework?
Well, you know, I think, Neil, that we've made much ado about very little concerning this learning style thing. You know, there may be some validity to the idea that some children are more visually oriented in their learning and some children are more auditory in their learning. But the fact of the matter is that if you put a visual learner in an auditory learning environment, that's going to be good for him because he's going to have to learn how to adjust his learning style. The marvelous thing about the human brain, I mean, nothing is fixed in the human brain. So people say, oh, my child's an auditory learner. He can't learn visually. And I go, no. No. You don't understand how the human brain works. The human brain is plastic. It's very adaptable. No animal brain is like this. This is one of the distinctions that God has conferred upon us, his special creation, is that our brains can adapt. And if your child is, let's say, an auditory learner and is put into a visual learning environment, that's good because his brain will learn to adapt to those new challenges and his abilities will actually improve and increase as a result of being put into a learning environment that isn't initially right in line with his particular learning style. So, you know, people think all of this stuff is set in stone. You know, my son's a visual learner, my son's an auditory learner, et cetera, et cetera. No, it's not set in stone, and it should not be regarded that way. If you regard it that way, you're actually, in the long run, doing the child a disservice.
You know, many of the schools today, it would seem, aren't really the right environments for learning because discipline can't be done because of policies. What do you recommend for parents if your child is in a school situation where there's, you know, where discipline isn't being meted out? And maybe more than that, we should talk about what do you do when your child misbehaves?
Well, the first question first, if your child is in a classroom setting where discipline is non-existent, or where the classroom atmosphere is chaotic because you've got a teacher who's not a very good disciplinarian, then, I would consider pulling my child out of school, and I would consider homeschooling at that point, moving him to a different school. Neil, you nailed the problem, and that is that in America's public schools, teachers are thrown into classrooms and told they are to control their classrooms, and then their hands are tied behind their backs by the rules and regulations when it comes to discipline. And so you find these terrible disciplinary situations in America's public schools today. And quite often, it's not the teacher's fault. It's the fault of the rules and regulations that that apply. One of the things that I say is that, you know, today's public schools, they're constantly looking over their shoulder to see if the lawyers are coming. And they're conducting – a lot of their rules and regulations are based on a fear that the lawyers are going to burst through the front door.
So let's talk about, what do you recommend when a child misbehaves at school?
Well, I mean, it depends on the a lot of variables. So when people ask me questions like this, I my answer is, well, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know until I know all the variables. Sure. But I'll take a shot at it, Neil, you know. Mm-hmm. But in general, in order to solve a behavior problem in the classroom, one thing is essential, and that is that the parents completely agree with the teacher's definition of the problem, and B, that the parents completely support the teacher's manner of dealing with the problem, and C, that the parents follow through with disciplinary consequences in the home. So if a child is misbehaving in school, there need to be consequences at home. There need to be punishments at home. And there are means of establishing the necessary communication between school and home, between the classroom and the home, that facilitate exactly that. And I talk about them in the book. One thing you can do is go to what I call a daily report card. And it's just simply a binary system. Billy obeyed the rules today. Billy had trouble obeying the rules today. Billy takes the daily report card up to his teacher at the end of the day. She checks one of those two boxes, signs the daily report. Billy brings it home, and his privileges depend on his receiving a check in the box that says he obeyed the rules. A very, very simple and effective way of dealing with classroom behavior. If you don't have parent cooperation, then all the teacher can do is control the behavior to the best degree that she can. She cannot solve the problem.
I know you've shared in your books at times. I mean, you had moments that when you were a disruptive student during your, I think, middle school and high school years. Talk about how maybe your parents dealt with you, and maybe how you dealt with your kids when they maybe acted out a time or two.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. It enables me to say that most of what I have learned, I would say 99.5% of what I have learned, I have learned retrospectively. I have learned by looking back on how my parents handled situations. And I have learned through the process of trial and error with my own kids. Most of what I was taught in college and graduate school was, quite frankly, Neil, it was worthless. And as far as the teaching went, it was very good teaching. It's just that the subject matter was, in the final analysis, it was worthless. It was theoretical. It wasn't practical. And so, yeah, I did have I was a outstanding student academically. I had the highest ACT score in my high school graduating class, which was 800 kids. I made straight A's through school. I was the kind of kid who didn't have to work very hard in order to make very, very good grades. And I was a good writer, and I could grasp concepts very, very quickly. And so in the seventh grade, for whatever reasons, you know, I don't think they were psychological. I just think, you know, I was having fun. I became the classroom behavior problem. And I became the class comedian. And I would disrupt it, not clown, but comedian. And I would disrupt the class, you know, as often as I could by interjecting remarks while the teacher was teaching and more. And nothing the teachers did worked because I was a straight A student. What could they do? And so finally, you know, they had me write sentences. They had me pick up garbage on the school grounds. They had me stay after school. And I didn't care. And I was having too much fun. So finally, one day, my parents went to the school for what I thought was just an ordinary, regular conference, teacher-parent conference. And they came home, and they sat me down. And my stepfather said, I'm only going to say this one time. If you are reprimanded for any reason by any teacher between now and the end of the school year, and this was February, you will repeat the seventh grade, no matter what your grades are. And I looked at him and went, what? And he said, no. I said I was only going to say it one time. But I'll repeat it for our radio audience. I mean, I it's burned into my brain. If you are reprimanded by any teacher for any reason between now and the end of the school year, you will repeat the seventh grade no matter what your grades are. And I said, but what if the teacher is wrong? And he said, I've already said what I have to say. And he got up and he walked out of the room. And the next day, my oppositional defiant disorder, my conduct disorder, my sociopathic narcissistic personality, my attention deficit disorder were all cured. I sat, paid attention, did my work, and made no remarks between that point and the end of the year, and did go to the eighth grade. And you know what that taught me, Neil? It taught me that, you know, if you really want to change a kid's behavior, you have to do something big. And I'll take this opportunity to say that most of what today's parents are doing in terms of consequences amount to nothing more than trying to stop charging elephants with fly swatters. And I learned so much from that experience, and I pass it on to parents today. I tell parents, you know, you want to use a punishment? The punishment should never fit the crime. It's a small crime, huge punishment. That's the way you stop the crime from growing beyond the initial small stage.
Practical advice, practical parenting wisdom from John Roseman. We've been talking about his book, John Roseman's Fail-Safe Formula for Helping Your Child Succeed. John's a family psychologist, has directed mental health programs, and been in full-time private practice, work with families, children, and parents for more than 40 years, writes and speaks regularly, and he is joining us today on Connecting Faith. We're going to kind of jump ahead to his latest book, Grandma Was Right After All, because there's some, obviously, tie-in for what we've been talking about already, and we'll come back in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we've been connecting today with John Roseman, who is a best-selling author, has worked with families, children, and parents for over 40 years in the field of family psychology, has practical wisdom about parenting. We've been talking about homework and school and gotten into some discipline issues. John just was talking about doing something big. His latest book is called Grandma Was Right After All, Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days. And one of the things that you say in that book, John, I thought we should just touch on is in terms of discipline or almost anything, you say that, you know, we shouldn't try to reason with a child. That seems like kind of a foundational issue today. Let's talk more about that.
Yeah, well, you know, today's parents believe that there's something psychologically damaging to the four words, because I said so. And I point out to parents that because I said so is nothing more than a statement that affirms the legitimacy of your authority where your children are concerned. And your authority over your children could be no more legitimate because it is assigned to you by God himself. And therefore, because your authority is assigned to you by God, you are acting as God's proxy in the raising of his children, you are not obligated to justify any decision you make, any instruction you give, any prohibition that you communicate to your child. And when you feel obligated to justify yourself, you get into arguments. And the so-called argumentative child is just simply responding logically to a parent who believes that it is right to explain yourself. And I point out, look, the general does not explain himself to the sergeant. The CEO of the corporation does not explain himself to the kid who works in the mailroom. Wherever you find legitimate authority operating, you don't find authority figures explaining themselves to people. When you explain yourself to your child, you sound like you are trying to persuade the child to go along with you. And that is completely different than conveying an instruction. And when you sound like you are trying to persuade your child to go along with you, honey, it would really help mommy to pick up these toys because my girlfriend is coming over and I'd like to serve her coffee and pastries in this room. So will you move these toys for mommy, okay? The end result of that is likely to be an argument. Why do I have to move? I was here first. Besides, you won't let me eat in here. How come you're going to eat in here with your girlfriend? It's not fair. I shouldn't have to move. And the parent comes to me and says, I have an argumentative child, John. And I say, no. You are the person creating these arguments by giving explanations. Why are you doing that? Well, I read a book that said children deserve reasons. Well, why do they deserve reasons? You know, why doesn't the sergeant deserve a reason? He's an adult. You're talking about a child. And I try and help parents understand that, look, in the first place, you can stop these arguments by simply not giving explanations. When the child asks why, which they will under those circumstances, you just simply say, well, because I said so. That's why. Turn around and walk out of the room. And parents are absolutely amazed, Neil, how quickly this produces obedience. And by the way, one of the things I point out is that the ultimate beneficiary of a child of obedience on the part of a child is the child. The research all indicates that the happiest kids are also the most obedient and vice versa. So if you want your kid to be happy, the research says the number one thing you need to do is make sure your child obeys you.
Interesting. Important understanding today about parenting. Would you say your parenting style is maybe sort of one of disengagement or what? I mean, is, you know, compared to maybe what most parents do today, how would you define it?
Well, it's not a high involvement parenting style, that is for sure. I believe that husband and wife ought to be highly involved with each other and that the parent-child relationship ought to take a place, it ought to be second fiddle to the marriage, and that's not happening in most American households today. In most American households, parents, unfortunately, even Christian families, unfortunately, the parents are paying more attention to and doing more for their children than they're paying attention to and doing for each other. And you put the marriage first, the kids come second. It's not a no-involvement, disengagement style, but it is a low-involvement form of parenting. And I compare it to a libertarian political philosophy. You give the child a lot of responsibility, and you give the child, through the assignment of responsibility, the opportunity to learn to develop and obtain a lot of freedom.
We were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, just your seventh grade adventures, and I know that you address issues like ADHD. that we've sort of lost what it means for boys to be boys and girls to be girls today. Just say a word about kind of how that affects how we treat our kids today.
How ADHD affects
Right, them. Yes.
Well, there is no, most people don't know that there's no scientific basis for the diagnosis whatsoever. And in fact, none of the diagnostic criteria are test-based. The idea that you have to test a child in order to arrive at a diagnosis of ADHD is bogus. It's simply a way for people to make money and create the impression that something scientific is being done to arrive at the diagnosis, when in fact all of the diagnostic criteria are subjective. They're not objective. They're not science-based. They're not medically based. It is a bogus diagnosis. Do some children have short IQ, short attention spans? Absolutely, Neil. Is there a compelling evidence that this is due to genes or biochemicals or inborn brain differences? No, there is no compelling evidence to any of that effect, although that's what you're going to hear from the professional community. Either they don't know what they're talking about, or they're downright not telling the truth, one or the other. The fact of the matter is that the introduction of electronics into the lives of the American children has, and the research is very clear on this, has depressed attention span, shortened attention span. The research is very, very clear that under certain circumstances, a child's attention span can rebound very quickly. I wrote a book called The Diseasing of America's Children with a very well-known, nationally respected pediatrician. We researched all of this for 10 years before writing the book, The Diseasing of America's Children. And we found that, he's a developmental and behavioral pediatrician. He began using non-medical means of treating children who had very short attention spans, were impulsive, who fit the criteria for the diagnosis, and began having tremendous success. One of the keys is pulling electronics out of the child's life. Most of the research indicates today that, A, children should not be exposed to electronic media until they're around 10 to 12 years old, and B, this is very interesting, that children achieve better in schools that do not have computers. That's fascinating, isn't it?
We want to find out more about that. Reminds me, John, if people want to find out more about your writing and the books and some of the research that you've compiled, what's the best way to get connected with you?
Well, I have a website at John Rosemond, R-O-S-E-M-O-N-D, J-O-H-N, R-O-S-E-M-O-N-D .com. And people can go to that website, and I've got a Facebook presence, and I occasionally am on Twitter and things like that. I'm not a big social media guy, but I'm that generation that social media is kind of what social means you talk to somebody face to face. But I do have a Facebook page, and I've got the Twitter thing, all that. So people can find out about my work fairly rapidly, johnrosemond.com.
Well, we're thankful that, John, you've chosen to talk with us today on the phone, and we look forward to maybe a face-to-face conversation sometime down the road. John Rosemond, family psychologist and a best-selling author. You can find out more about his writings at johnrosemond.com. His latest book is called Grandma Was Right After All, Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days. And, John, it's good to visit with you again. Thank you for carving out some time today and for the great work you're doing.
Thank you. It's always enjoyable for me to talk to you, too, Neil, anytime.
You've been listening to Connecting Faith, and we post our interviews online after the show. You can check it out at myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page.